Subject today is Judges chapter 5, better known as the Song of Deborah. Now, we started studying it in earnest last week. We ended with verse 11, and we're going to continue to carefully dissect this song because there's so much to be gleaned from it. It has so much to say about our modern lives and the age in which we live, whether we're Jews or Gentiles. And we're still not going to finish it up today. Now, further, the era of the judges explains to us why there would then be an era of the kings to immediately follow it. And this song provides us with some important clues about the progress of Israel as both a spiritual and a national entity. Now, as a sort of preface to our learning what we can take theologically and as life applications from the Song of Deborah, I stress that we must first and foremost understand that the very nature of the type of literature called song that makes up the entirety of Judges 5 is unique in itself. And that nature is that significant liberties are taken with the words and phrases in order for it to make an impact. Therefore, the point of a song, whether it's a song in the Bible or a song composed for human entertainment like rock and roll, isn't necessarily to impart concise or terribly accurate information. It's for the authors to pour out their souls. It's to express their feelings. And those feelings will center on current events in the culture that we're living in, such as if there's war or a weather calamity or a few years of relative peace, a national mood of darkness and despair, whatever it is. So to understand a song, any song, means by definition we must understand the context of the times and of the society in which it was created. Because if we try to take the words of a biblical song fully literally, or we try to hold it above its era or its culture, we're going to miss the point. Or worse, we're going to create some kind of misguided but far-reaching philosophy or all-encompassing doctrine and declare it as universal and make it rigid. What I'm getting at is that while the essence of the Song of Deborah is truthful, we need to be careful to not take every word as an accurate and balanced portrayal of a significant historical event. The Song of Deborah was made to commemorate and transmit to future generations the great and joyful, at least it was to Israel, military victory of the northern tribes of Israel led by Deborah's sidekick, Barak, over the Canaanite coalition army led by Sisera on behalf of King Yavin of Hazor. And we finished up last time by discussing an important theme in the first third of the Song of Deborah, and it had to do with leadership. Leadership. And we find that Deborah mostly blames this dire situation Israel finds itself in, under the thumb of some oppressive Canaanites, on the lack of leadership from Israel's tribal chieftains and elders. So she also extols the virtues of herself and of a handful of men who rose up to become leaders in order to lead Israel out of their doldrums and out of their passivity to fight the good fight in order to restore their liberties and to regain their proper relationship with the God of Israel, even though it was going to be a dangerous and unpopular thing to do. Now, it's important that we understand that while the Lord has authorized the establishment of human governments, he also requires that those who are to lead with a servant's heart and for the welfare of the people they govern are to rise up and be the governors. But even then, it must not be accomplished by means of enforcing their own ideas of humanitarian ideologies or what seems good to them to be decent and just. Rather, it's the word of God. It's the Lord's direction that the leaders are to fully commit to. And then the result of that obedience will be that the people are properly cared for, and then they will receive a divine blessing from all this. Now, we have in our times one of the greatest examples of a probably well-meaning but misguided leadership as it pertains to our own nation. I mean, I think particularly if we think about our previous president, who on the one hand claims strongly to be connected to the God of Israel and his son Yeshua, on the other hand often preferred his own concepts of mercy and justice to the Lord's specific commandments. Of course, what I'm referring to is Israel and his administration's embrace of the infamous roadmap to peace, whereby Israel is being relentlessly pressured to divide Jerusalem, give up the Temple Mount, carve off pieces of the promised land that are to be handed over to sworn enemies. In fact, in a speech given on May 19th of 2011, that president openly demanded that Israel return to their 1967 borders, giving away their own land, putting Jewish towns and cities under Palestinian control in exchange for another series of hollow promises for peace. Why would he do this? Because to his geopolitical way of thinking, it would bring peace, it would promote brotherly love, that it seems to be fair, balanced to all parties involved, and so it must be the right thing to do. I mean, it was sincere. But I'm sorry to say, this kind of leadership is condemned in the Bible. Because while it might seem that the actions of a leader attempting to be fair can bring a short-term earthly benefit, it also brings a longer-term, inescapable chastisement from Jehovah. See, our good intent and our sincerity have never, will never, trump our obedience to the Lord. And such errors in our leadership, well, that can have devastating effects upon their people and upon the nation they lead. And this is what we see happening in Judges. So let's read a little bit more of Judges chapter 5. Judges chapter 5, we're going to read verses 12 through 18. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 275. Judges chapter 5, starting with verse 12. Awake! Awake, Zipporah, Deborah. Awake, awake and break into song. Arise, Barak, lead away your captives, son of Avinoam. Then a remnant of the nobles marched down. The people of Adonai marched down to me like warriors. From Ephraim came those rooted in Amalek. Behind you, Benjamin is with your peoples. From Machir, the commanders marched down. And from Zebulun, those holding the musterer's staff. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah. Issachar along with Barak. Into the valley they rushed forth behind him. Among the divisions of Reuben, they made great resolutions in their hearts. But why did you stay at the pens for the sheep and listen to the shepherd's flute playing for the flocks? Concerning the divisions of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Gilead lives beyond the Jordan. Dan, why does he stay by the ships? Asher stayed by the shore of the sea, remaining near its bays. the people of Zebulun risked their lives. Naphtali, too, on the open heights. Now, we could probably give this stanza of the Song of Deborah, the name, the roll call of the tribes, because it begins to speak of each of the tribes' enthusiastic participation in Israel's liberation, or of their ambivalence and disinterest in joining in the holy war that the Lord has called for. Verse 12 has Deborah exhorting herself to awaken and do what she must, which is to throw herself into this great event that she initiated as the Lord's earthly agent, and now to equally throw herself into commemorating that event through song. She also calls on Barak to lead away his prisoners of war. So we see two roles explained here. Deborah was the prophet, while Barak was the deliverer. And as the prophet, Deborah represents God's presence, or at the very least, his voice. Barak was the one who was to act upon the instructions of the Lord. Verse 13 gives us the response of Deborah's call to Israel for holy war. And we are told that only a remnant of the noble ones, the new leadership, and only some of the brave of the nation heeded her call, meaning that many refused to serve. Apathy was the mood in Israel at this time. And the sense of verses 12 and 13 is that it would fall to the prophetess Deborah to shake the people out of their deep sleep. So verse 14 then throws us a king-size curveball. It says that Ephraim came to join the battle, but they were rooted in Amalek. And since there is no sense that this is a negative comment, then we have the problem of figuring out just what that means. What does that mean, rooted in Amalek? Now, obviously, Ephraim was not genetically or nationally rooted in Amalek. Amalek was an age-old enemy of Israel that will only be destroyed once and for all when the Messiah returns. So what is the idea behind saying that the tribe of Ephraim was rooted in Amalek? Well, there's a few opinions floating around about how to take this statement. One is that there was a minor copyist error, and that Amalek was accidentally substituted for Emek. Emek is Hebrew for valley. Saying that Ephraim was rooted, came from the valleys, is certainly true, and it does fit. But Rashi, great Jewish rabbi, scholar, says that the word translated as in other words, rooted in Amalek, ought to be more properly translated as against, rooted against Amalek. Thus, we have Ephraim properly defined as being against Amalek. The great Bible scholar, German Bible scholar Kiel, says that the translation of rooted in Amalek is just fine, as it is, if we understand that Ephraim took much of their territory away from the Amalekites. In other words, the area where Ephraim now lived was formerly called Amalek. Thus, it could be said they were rooted, they lived in an area that used to be known as Amalek. The bottom line here is, for sure, this cannot mean Ephraim had some sort of national or genetic connection to Amalek. Ephraim was Joshua's tribe, and it was Deborah's tribe. So it's no wonder it got top billing in her song. Now, the next part of this same verse is that some from the tribe of Benjamin came to fight once enough people from the tribe of Ephraim had committed to fight. And a few interesting nuances to this piece of information shouldn't be ignored. The rabbis say that this is actually a prophetic pronouncement with the meaning that Ephraim fights against these Canaanites, and sometime later, so will Benjamin. And that sometime later turned out to be 1020 BC, when King Saul of the tribe of Benjamin fought to claim back more territory from the Canaanites. Another line of thought is that since Benjamin's territory is located to the south of Ephraim, Benjamin was physically behind Ephraim. Now, I have to tell you that my opinion is we have a lot of speculation about what is meant in this very simple statement. Ephraim committed first. It was probably the largest tribe of them all at this time. And so Benjamin followed suit. That's simple. Again, this is a song. And we're off the mark to try to tear every word or phrase apart, trying to find something much deeper. The words are chosen as much for how well they rhyme as for what they actually mean. Next, we find that the military commander, or commanders actually, of Machir, also decided to supply some troops for this battle. Now, you don't need to get confused by this. Saying Machir is actually referring to the tribe of Manasseh, but it was actually known as Machir in Deborah's day. Manasseh, the founder of the tribe, had only one son, and that son's name was Machir. Machir was at one point the accepted tribal leader over Manasseh, but in typical Middle Eastern culture, it was more usual that a tribal leader would have many sons, each of whom would head up his own clan within that tribe. The firstborn of the tribal founder would, by custom, eventually become the new leader over the tribe. Although, if another of the tribal founder's sons headed a clan that became more powerful than the firstborn son's clan, then the more powerful clan leader might become the overall tribe leader instead. The point is that with a tribal founder having multiple sons that thus produce multiple clans, the identification of the tribe of Manasseh in this case, would remain the same even with a new tribal leader. But when only one son is produced, he bears a status almost as great as the original tribal founder. So it was not uncommon for a tribal name to change, to bear the name of that only child when that only child assumed leadership. So we find the tribe of Manasseh is being called Machir at this point in history rather than its original name, Manasseh. So Manasseh and Machir were virtually interchangeable terms, all right, at that time. Now, I'm not trying to turn y'all into Bible historians, but this situation is a terrific example of just how challenging the Bible can be if you don't do your homework. If you recall, when Moses led Israel up to the Jordan River, about half of the clans that formed the tribe of Manasseh didn't want to go into the Promised Land. They wanted to stay on the east bank of the Jordan River. Interestingly, it was Machir, the tribal chieftain of Manasseh, plus some number of other clans of Manasseh who wanted to make their new roots in the Transjordan, the east side of the river. But Machir was apparently okay with the idea of some of the other clans of his tribe crossing over the river and claiming territory there as well. So for Machir, the good news was he would preside over two large territories, both under the banner of his tribe, Manasseh. Now, one might think it wouldn't take too long before one of the clan leaders who occupied the western territorial area of Manasseh would rise up and stake their claim as a tribal leader of that group, leaving Machir and his successor as the tribal leader of the eastern section of Manasseh. But what Deborah's song shows us is that that not only perhaps even after 150 years, had not occurred, but also the use of the tribal name Manasseh actually became inferior to the name of Machir. So even the western clans of Manasseh went by the name of Machir. It was these western clans, western side of the Jordan River, that came to fight. Because as we're soon going to see, those tribes, Israelite tribes, who remained on the east side of the Jordan River had little interest in assisting their brethren who lived in the promised land. Well, next, Zebulun is mentioned. He is said to be holding the muster's staff, or in some translations it says the marshal's staff. Now, if you have a King James version, it'll say that Zebulun is holding the pen of the writer. I mean, let's face it, not one of these translations is much help to us as to figure out what in the world they even mean. I mean, who are those who hold the muster's staff? Who are those that hold the pen of the writer? However, I'm pretty confident is that the King James Version's probably got the closer sense of it. We're just going to have to flesh it out a little bit more. What the phrase literally says is, the rod of they who handle the pen of the scribe. Now, that's a mouthful. Now, a rod is usually a symbol of authority in ancient times. But a scribe was not a royal person who had governing authority. Rather, the rod of a scribe is referring to his writing instrument, his pen, if you would. His pen was his rod. Very few people in the age of the judges could write. So a scribe's job was usually to record a king's pronouncements or handle his accounting records. Well, a scribe was held in very high esteem. However, many ancient rabbis say that is used here, the phrase is an idiom. In other words, saying the rod of a scribe is merely a lofty or poetic way of saying men who use a pen, men who can write. And of course, we are dealing with a song here full of lofty words. Further, Zebulun was known to be heavily involved in trading. They were known as a merchant tribe. Merchants were among the few outside of actual scribes that were known to write because they had accounts they had to keep track of. However, the original Hebrew does not say that the men being referred to as continuing to do battle were scribes, sofertim. Rather, it's that these particular men used the instrument that was the chief tool of a scribe. Thus, what this verse is actually referring to is that even merchants, men who were trained in buying and selling, not in warfare, even they rose up in religious fervor among Zebulun, and they responded to Deborah's call to arms. So it's a big praise for them. Verse 15 says that members of the tribe of Issachar volunteered for battle as well. Then we get to Reuben. Now, up to this point in the roll call of the tribes, all has been of a very positive nature. Nah, changes with Reuben. And what a lesson for modern Jews and Christians is the tribe of Reuben's and some of the other tribes' response. Let's pay close attention so we either don't make the same mistakes, or if as our lives as believers, we're already doing what they did, we need to repent and turn back. What Reuben did was to have a long and heartfelt discussion about what to do when the Lord called them to holy war. Do they join their brethren, as they know they should, on the opposite side of the Jordan River, as their leaders from the days of Moses promised they would do, if they were allowed to settle in the Transjordan, in other words, the eastern side of the river? Or do they view the battles against Sisera and Yavin as a foreign conflict that was none of their business? because it wasn't in their own backyard. Here we also encounter another translation problem. In the Complete Jewish Bible, along with several other versions, it says in the second half of verse 15 concerning the divisions of Reuben. The Hebrew word being translated as divisions is pelaga. And pelaga is a word that is always associated with waterways, like rivers and streams. And it is usually meant to denote a place where a river divides or branches off into rivulets, or what we would more commonly call today brooks. And the Hebrew sages are pretty unanimous that this ought to be translated as, among the brooks of Reuben, they made great resolutions in their hearts. In other words, the territory occupied by Reuben was well known as being pretty well watered. It had many brooks and streams that crisscrossed the land. So the picture is of the leaders and the nobles of Reuben sitting around discussing the matter in a sort of defeatist or even a detached way. And they were gathering along the many pastoral water courses of their territory and opining, why would they want to leave for a holy war and risk so much? Answer, they didn't and they wouldn't. Instead, if they just stayed safe and sound by their many sheepfolds that they had erected for their abundant flocks, and they listened to the lovely, enchanting musical notes coming from the flutes some shepherds would play to pass the time, they'll again be safe. I hope you're getting the picture. This is a derogatory remark about Reuben, whereby Deborah is basically bordering on calling them cowards and traitors. At the least, Reuben was essentially disavowing their familial obligation and the past promises to Moses and to God to stand with their fellow Israelites against their common enemies. Well, now, verse 17 says that Gilead, meaning Gad, lives across the Jordan. In other words, they live next to Reuben. In other words, it has now been established that all the Israelite tribes and their clans who live separated from the Promised Land, those tribes who decided so many years earlier, they preferred the fertility and the peacefulness of the Transjordan to the Promised Land offered by God, these so-called 2 1/2 Israelite tribes of the Transjordan had begun the inevitable mental process, follow me, of disassociating themselves from the 9 1/2 tribes who went forward into that Promised Land and live there now. And such a disassociation means they had no interest in coming to the aid of their Israelite brothers when they needed them the most. And especially when these 2 1/2 tribes hoped that those troubles would just bypass them. Well, then the tribe of Dan is called on the carpet. Why Dan? The Song of Deborah asks rhetorically. Why, Dan, do you just stay by the ships? Implying, of course, that the Danites are staying near their homes by the sea, instead of coming to fight at Mount Tabor alongside several other tribes. Now, technically, Dan was located on the seacoast with a good port at Joppa. However, they didn't ever control much of the seacoast in their assigned territory for very long. Dan was known to have forged an alliance with the Phoenicians, who were also seafarers located a little bit north of Joppa. And likely, Dan was already on the move to relocate northwards at the time of Deborah. In any case, Dan certainly had a political problem on their hands of some proportion. Their alliance with the Phoenicians was a very important one for them. It was their bread and butter. And if they helped their brother Israelites to fight against what would have been Canaanite allies of Phoenicia, well, you see the bind Dan found themselves in. It was the classic case of damned if you do, damned if you don't. course, they were wrong. Their duty before God was to fight for their brothers, not to feather their nests with twigs from the world. Asher, who was also sea merchants, they lived along the Mediterranean. They, of course, had alliances too. Being merchants along the seacoast was big business. And by definition, their trading partners, well, they would have been Gentiles that often had alliances with many of the same Canaanite kings, as did Dan and the Phoenicians. It was a delicate situation. So Asher, along with Dan, decided not to risk their tribal economic advantage by fighting alongside their brethren. This stanza of the song ends the roll call of the tribes in verse 18 by explaining that as opposed to the wrong-minded decisions by Reuben, Gad, and the Transjordan portion of Manasseh along with Dan and Asher, the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali put their lives and their family lives and their livelihoods on the line in order to answer Jehovah's call through his prophet, Deborah. Now, I suppose if there were just a few, five or six of us here, I might stop and ask at this point, each of you individually, what you're thinking right about now after listening to this lesson. Because here in Judges chapter 5, we have the Lord wanting to continue his holy war to both liberate Israel from their enemies and to continue to establish his holy kingdom on earth in the promised land. Deborah and Barak were his vehicles for the moment to this end. Many from several of the 12 tribes answered the call. Some entire tribes sat on their hands and just pretended not to notice. Interestingly, there is no mention at all of Judah or Simeon. Now, I demonstrated in earlier lessons that there already had been established a north versus south mentality among the 12 tribes. Judah and Simeon at this time were the south. Benjamin vacillated in their loyalties back and forth between the north and the south due to their geographical location, and the remaining tribes, including the ones in our story, were generally considered part of the north. However, here we see that in addition to the north-south alignment, there was also an east-west division that had arisen. Those 2.5 tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan River really didn't see that they had any solid attachment or obligation to those 9.5 tribes living on the western side of the river. Things change. About a century earlier, the tribes in the Transjordan were terribly concerned that they might be excluded from the commonwealth of Israel by those 9.5 tribes who went into Canaan. Now, they're separating themselves away. So what we have here is a very detailed description of a very fractured Israel at the time of the judges, just like we have a terribly fractured Christianity, an equally fractured Judaism today. I can also tell you that the reborn nation of Israel is also very divided within itself. Each group, denomination, sect, clan, tribe, cares only for its own interests. And, you know, as like with Reuben, some of the other tribes had endless hand-wringing sessions about what their obligations ought to be to their brethren. You can bet there were those Levite priests and elders who tried with all their might to remind the various Hebrew clan leaders of Moses and Joshua's instructions to stay true to the one God and to his commandments. And that meant they had to work together to continue to fight for the establishment of God's kingdom in the promised land. But the attitude for many of the people was, let somebody else do it. It seemed dangerous to their personal wealth and power, dangerous to their own economy, dangerous to their mortal lives. For some, it was simply an interruption in their everyday comforts that they just didn't want. Today, I would ask you, if you're a Jew, why are you not making plans to migrate to Israel, to the promised land that's all set apart for you? If you're a Gentile Christian, why are you not standing up for Yeshua, standing with Israel, boldly professing the universal sovereignty of the God of Israel? Are you content just to leave that to others? Whether Jew or Gentile Christian, what are you actively doing to help Israel to fight to keep the holy land that God gave to them? The same holy land is not only the birthplace of our Savior, but the same land to which he's going to pretty soon return. What are you doing beyond experiencing simple emotion, maybe guilt, about hanging back from going over there to visit God's people or speaking out to an uninformed church on behalf of God's people or spending some of your resources, even sacrificially, to directly comfort God's people? The tribe of Reuben discussed this among themselves. They wrestled with it earnestly in their hearts. But also they turned their eyes away. And they determined better to simply leave it at feeling badly than to disrupt their own lives. Asher and Dan had valuable friendships and business partnerships with those who worshipped other gods. And those friendships were economically beneficial to them. So they refused to get involved. Gad and the portion of Manasseh that lived across the geographical boundary that served to separate them physically from their brethren didn't want to suffer their brother's troubles. Yet they also didn't want to give up their common identity as Hebrews and as Israel. So they kept their distance, hoping they would just be left alone by the enemy and everything would just kind of work out. Sort of interesting how it all turned out. Those Israelites on the east side of the Jordan River who sought to appease the enemy kind of fly under the radar, hope to avoid the fate of their brethren. Do you know what? They were the very first to be scattered and assimilated by Israel's enemies in later times. Dan gave up. They just vacated their allotted territory in the promised land altogether, and they moved far north, where they also gave up their God, and they set up pagan calf worship, and a remnant actually wound up in northern Africa. With the recent discovery of substantial remnants of each of the 10 lost tribes of Israel in the last decade or two, the only tribe not found yet is Asher, who refused to get involved in the fight and rather chose to throw in their lot with their Gentile business partners. Asher preferred their profitable ports and their serene beaches to the battlefields of holy war. Let's read just a little bit more. Open your Bibles back up again. We're going to read verses 19 through 22 of Judges 5. Kings came and they fought. Yes, the kings of Canaan fought at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo, but they took no spoil of silver. They fought from heaven, the stars in their courses. Yes, they fought against Sisera. The Kishon River swept them away, that ancient river, the Kishon River. Oh, my soul, march on with strength. Then the horses' hooves pounded the ground, their mighty steeds galloping at full speed. Verse 19 tells us about the Canaanite coalition army, where it says that they took no spoil of silver. It means that these were not mercenary soldiers. Rather, they were loyal nationalist troops. They were Canaanites bent on ejecting or subjugating Israel. Now, verse 20 is difficult to deal with because it's hard to tell if the reference to the stars is meant to be spiritual or natural. That is, stars in heaven are often in the Bible a metaphor or symbolic for angels. Lucifer, the devil, is called the brightest and most beautiful star. So this could mean that Deborah is saying that in parallel with the human battle on the ground, there was a spiritual battle in the heavenlies going on for Israel. That would certainly fall in line with Hebrew and biblical thinking in general. On the other hand, it could be referring to the weather, which favorably and unexpectedly altered the battle for Israel's sake. Either way, it's referring to something supernatural and divine. Verse 21 explains the involvement of the Kishon River in the war. That is, while it identifies the place where it all happened, it also explains that the river itself became the Lord's vehicle for giving victory to Israel. The river, we're told, swept them away, meaning swept away the Canaanite troops. In other words, something caused a trickle of water that could have barely qualified as a brook in the summertime, at the time of the year that this battle occurred, to become a raging torrent that overflowed the Kishon's banks and muddied the surrounding fields in every direction, thus rendering the fearsome chariots of the Canaanites that gave them a huge battlefield advantage, rendered them useless. The river is spoken of as that ancient river, meaning that it was indeed very well known. It was a place that had seen countless generations and races of people live upon its banks and water their fields with its flow. What we're undoubtedly witnessing here, what's being talked about, is a flash flood. This is not an uncommon experience in Israel in the summer months. But what makes it so notable, of course, is the timing. It occurred at the Lord's command, and it was supernatural in its ferocity. So in poetic fashion, verse 22 speaks of horses stamping as they slip and slide in the mud, rearing up in panic as they pulled in vain on those heavy iron chariots they're attached to, because those chariots just become like anchors just sinking into the muck. So an army based on now immobilized chariots becomes easy prey for an army based on foot soldiers. In chapter 4, we read about how some of the chariots were able to escape, many more were abandoned, and the Canaanite soldiers, along with their leader, Sisera, just ran off on foot to try and escape. Israel chased them down and slaughtered them. The victory of the great divine warrior leader, Jehovah, was lopsided, and it was complete on that auspicious day. We're going to finish this up next week and move on into Judges chapter 6.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.